Hey, everybody. This is Alex Lindsay, and this is the VFX show number 7. And we're here with Ron Brinkman. Ron, you're back from Iceland, right?
I'm back from, I was actually over in London for a week doing the whole Shake announcement thing, seeing a lot of the major customers over there in Soho. And after that, then, yes, a week of fun driving around Iceland.
Just pure fun. There was no... Yep. You weren't doing any Shake tutorials
Nope.
over there?
No, there's a few production companies and stuff in Reykjavik, and there's a fair bit of stuff going on, and I was thinking it'd be good to get together with some of them, but, you know, when push came to shove, it was like, oh, no, let's go climb a mountain instead. So, and when I say driving around Iceland, I mean driving all the way around, as in the perimeter.
How long does it take you to drive around Iceland?
We were there for like 9-10 days, you know, most of that, but that wasn't harsh driving. I mean, I don't think we did more than maybe 3 or 4 hours any given day.
Right.
So, I mean, the main road all the way around is quite good, so it's not too bad.
It's definitely a place I want to.
It's spectacular, and it's, I mean, it was a fun time of year to be there because the summer solstice had just happened about 3 days before we got there, so I saw no darkness for 10 days.
Now I have another question for you, Ron. That's been coming up inside the Pixel Core. Now, are you planning to update your book?
As a matter of fact, I am working on that slowly but surely. God, it's such a pain. But yes, I the original plan was, you know, my publisher talked me into it. It's been a while because the book was published in, I guess, 99 or so.
Right.
So it's been a while. I mean, when I wrote it originally, that it was sort of intended to be something that wouldn't go out of date too quickly. I mean, there's no software specific stuff in there. It's all about concepts and everything like that, but it's been a while. And the main thing originally I was like, all right, I'm just going to update the case studies and get something a little bit more, you know, up to date than Independence Day or some of the other stuff that are in there. So I got started on that. And then of course the usual studio lawyers, paperwork, bureaucracy stuff set in, and it's just taken forever. And in the meantime, I'm like, well, you know, I should probably touch this, and well, I could do a little update on that. And so in the interim, I'm touching all kinds of little things here and there.
Well, that would be great. And that's the art and science of digital compositing.
The art and science of digital compositing.
And it is, you know, for the folks listening, in the Pixel Core, we have kind of this process of internally of training people, which is that you, you know, when we have people here in the office, it's basically we throw them the Shake book and have them work through it. And then we have them work through generally Steve Wright's book. The Shake book is pure, just click this, move this over, and to kind of get people set up for it. And then Steve Wright's book is go figure out how to do all these pieces. And then we just have we have everyone read through Ron's book to understand why they were clicking on all those things.
Yeah, my book is a lot more sort of the fundamentals of concepts and that kind of thing, and Steve's is more sort of practical, putting some of that to use kind
right.
of stuff. So they really complement each other quite well, I think.
Yeah, and we find that those are good mixes. Also here with us is Mike Seymour from Down Under. Hey, Mike.
G'day, guys.
And Mike, of course, is from FX Guide, not VFX Guide. I've been corrected a couple times. Sure, I say that correctly. It's funny because I have it. But for me, it's on a link on Safari, and so I just click on it, and so I don't often think about what it was. So anyway, from FX Guide,
well,
and also
when we set up the site, we figured what would be a good name that would survive, and so we tried to make it independent of anything.
Right.
And we thought FX, but over the years, VFX has kind of grown as the thing. But when we started, it was just FX. So
and probably VFX Guide is owned by somebody not actually doing anything.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a VFX guide. I know there's a bunch of other VFX things, but we're just FX Guide and FX PhD, our training site.
And how is FX PhD going?
Oh, it's going really, really well. In fact, I've been up in Queensland, not as interesting as Reykjavik, but I've been up in Queensland organizing a shoot for next term. We like to have professional stuff that people can work with in the training sessions and then during the term. And we're going to be shooting with the miniatures crew off Superman, doing a whole lot of about 10-foot-high miniatures, and we're going to be shooting with the Genesis camera on the Milo rig, so pretty much recreating what they did on Superman and doing multi-pass stuff with that. And we're doing a masterclass with a DOP on how to light miniatures and then taking all that through post and Mayer and and compositing and stuff, so that'll be good.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, we like to everyone's kicked in. It's been really generous of Warner's and everybody. We were shooting on the backlot at Warner's. We're not shooting Superman models, of course. We're just recreating the pipeline that was used, and the guys at Photon have been really generous. So that'll be starting. We're the halfway, just past halfway of term one, and term two starts in around the 20th of August. So that's good.
That's great. Are you gonna do anything like that in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, it's funny. We were going to do this one in Los Angeles with the guys at New Deal, and it was going to be a multiple pass space thing, and that didn't come together quite the way we were hoping, as fast as we'd hoped. And so we shifted gear to doing it in Australia, and I was really interested to do it with the Genesis camera because I've used Panavision cameras for a long time, and I was really keen to get some files off the Genesis and look at the response curves of that. And it all just so happened that with friends, and we're doing something in cooperation with the Australian Cinematographers Society, so that'll be really good. And then we're also introducing color correction into our courses this coming term too. So one of the colorists will be on set, and then we'll talk to the DOP and the colorist, and then he'll go through with DaVinci training on how to color grade the shots and stuff. So it should be good. We'll definitely be doing stuff like this in different countries.
Sounds really good.
We had a good shoot this term. We were doing time splice, the Matrix stuff with multiple camera rigs.
Uh-huh.
So that we did that this term with Mark Ruff's multi-camera rig, and we also did some green screen stuff, and but all of that was 35mm, and this is going to be Genesis, so that'll be good.
Sounds really good. So definitely check that out. That's at, am I going to say this right? fxphd.com, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep, absolutely.
Definitely check that out. And this week, of course, we are digging into Pirates of the Caribbean, which was a visual effects extravaganza.
Indeed.
I think that there's no other way to describe it other than a visual effects extravaganza. Now, Ron, what did you think of the overall, just the experience of the movie?
I thought it was great. It was exactly what I was looking for, and it was just good fun,
Yeah, I thought it was a bit of a ride. Now, Mike, what did you think as far as the movie?
Yeah, I thought it was like a rollicking good ride. It was everything that I wanted, and I love Johnny Depp, and I particularly love the Rolling Stones. And so, as he based his character on Keith Richards, just love that film to death.
Yeah, I have a lot of I think that I saw some of the reviews and they seemed really bad, and
they were. Yeah, there was a lot of unkind reviews.
The worst review I have to say is that we just saw it was Ask a Ninja.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the roughest one, but one of the funnier ones. So I would definitely suggest someone. There's nothing to do with VFX. In fact, I'd love to help work with Ask a Ninja with the VFX that they use for their show. But it was really good. But a lot of these guys are really rough with it. And I guess I was like, what did you go expecting?
Hey, yeah, I mean, I would see 10 times before I'd see, something like Poseidon again. I mean, it's
right.
There was just a lot of fun there. Everybody was having fun, and, it's what you want.
It's a Disney movie with Jerry Bruckheimer based on a ride at a theme park. It's not going to be Hamlet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and when I saw some of these, I was like, so did you actually see the first one? And were you expecting something different?
Yeah,
exactly. So anyway, my overall was I enjoyed it. My wife enjoyed it, and she doesn't care about the visual effects, and so that's always a good sign. And it was a good overall movie. Now
I think you're totally right about it being the reminiscent of the ride stuff. I mean, there were scenes in there where it's been a long time since I've been to Disney World or Disneyland, but it was just like, I think that was in the ride, stuff that was reminiscent of it.
Right.
Oh, there were shots that were, like, there was a guy coming out of a well. It was just a recreation
that one I caught
of the
that
ride.
One. Yeah, the guy that bobs up and down. Yep.
Yeah, nice in-joke.
So overall, what caught your eye, Ron? What did you enjoy the most from the visual effects?
For me, this movie is all about Davy Jones.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic, I thought. I was just staring at that stuff, and it's really, I mean, the stuff's there now. It's really pretty amazing. I mean, and I was looking at it thinking, all right, now, how much of that is CG? I mean, that, maybe there's some real stuff in there because it looks so good.
And I have to say that there were some shots. There were a couple outdoor day shots on the deck.
Yep.
You know, with Davy Jones and his crew, that I just thought were, I mean, it looks so beautiful.
Yep.
You know, as far as the lighting.
Well, and for me also just, you know, I mean, some of that, I mean, really extreme close-ups of, you know, facial stuff and, you know, water dripping down it and all the atmospheric stuff going on. It was in there. I mean, it's really interesting to me. I wouldn't have predicted 5 years ago that you go see a movie like this and the stuff that's 100%, you know, I'd call perfect is the CG stuff, and the stuff where the flaws are in the compositing.
Right.
You know, I mean, because at this point, that's the stuff that still has problems I'm seeing, whereas the CG stuff is just in there.
Right. And
I wouldn't have predicted that. You know, I would have thought that the compositing technology, I guess that's my fault, would have gotten better.
Hey, they were using a program that was related to you.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
I think that the problem with compositing a lot of the time is that they take it for granted on set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to get the CG right, I mean, they're going crazy. I mean, I guess they have a fair bit of coverage on this in Post magazine online, and to get a lot of this stuff sorted out, you know, of course they were doing motion capture on set of the characters so that you get the right interaction, and it was a much lighter version. I guess they had to rebuild the way they were doing some of the mocap, but they were doing all of that stuff on set. They really went through all the beats that they had to go through to get these great characters. They were afraid of the 3D. I mean, they were afraid of the characters, and they turned out great.
Yeah.
What they're not afraid of is the blue screen.
Yep.
You know,
and I don't want to give the impression that I think the blue screen was, you know, the compositing stuff was as good as anything that's out there, really. But it's just, I couldn't find flaws in the CG, whereas if I'm looking for it, I can still see, okay, I know that was a composite. I mean, a lot of that's because I know where to look, and it's just like, okay, I bet if I stare at this, you know, little vertical post that somebody did some rotor around it, and I watch it for, yeah, okay, then you can kind of see it, but
the only,
you know, it's not something that grabs your eye.
I really felt like the only place the compositing really jumped out for me that was particularly hard was right when Johnny Depp is about to get, you know, about to jump into the beast, you know, in that hole, into the Kraken.
Right.
When he's standing there, there was a lot of soft mats.
Yeah.
You know, that was the one. And I felt like they must've decided that later or something where it was rotoed or something, because it just, that was a soft composite.
I mean, my theory on compositing at this point for blue screen stuff and everything with masks is it's just that this isn't going to get, it's not going to get better until we're doing full on acquisition at least 4K and maybe 8K,
right?
Because I think we're getting, you know, we're hitting the resolution limits where you've got, you know, your edges, just the capture medium isn't enough. I think you're going to have to be doing stuff at higher resolution and then downsampling.
But I think it's also related to what you were saying earlier, Alex, is that I think that on set, it's just now, it's almost a trend. I'm hearing it from people working in LA where directors refuse to have a green screen. They just say, let's roto it, because they don't want to have to bend to having a green screen there. And that, you know, it's really hard to roto to the level that you can keep professionally.
Yep.
And it's not just, you know, everybody's rotoing, and then the other side of the other side of what you're working on is you get this situation where where your green screens are changing all over the place. So they just kind of cobble together a green screen background, and they just kind of throw it back there, and there are lighter greens and darker greens and all kinds of whatever they could find. I mean, that's what I've gotten plates like that.
Sure. Yeah. And you got lighting issues.
I mean,
especially if you're shooting outdoors, and
yeah,
absolutely.
I don't know anyone who would compile a list of top five visual effects supervisors that wouldn't put John Knoll in the top five.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy is just totally beyond,
well,
you know.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
Yeah,
no, but he himself said that they had some, you know, tons of smoke and tons of stuff between the foreground and the green screen, and that made for a really, really hard compositing show.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
And again, the stuff looked good. You know, the first shots that I noticed it on were when they were at sort of the top of the hill being chased by the natives and the giant rolling ball thing that, you know, and there was just a lot of that. I get clued in because the lighting isn't quite right sometimes. You know, you feel like they weren't quite in the shot, and then I start looking for this stuff and I see it. But I don't think anything's going to change with this sense that directors don't want to use green screen. I think you're just going to see more and more and more of that.
Right.
And so in my mind, it's sort of get over it. It's not going to get better in terms of having good green screens or blue screens anymore. So that's why I said I think the only solution is, you know, if you're capturing double or quadruple the detail
that you need,
than you get now, then you can do a tighter roto and you can see those details that just don't, you know, something that is, you know, 4 pixels wide, if it becomes 16 pixels, then you can do an accurate roto on it that you couldn't before.
Right.
And I think that's really the only solution to this.
Yeah, and I said it's, we're talking about, I mean, for me, there were probably only 6 or 8 shots out of 1,500 visual effects or 1,400 visual effects shots that really jumped out at me like that.
Yep.
I mean, for the most part, it was, I mean, this is probably one of the, I mean, and this is truly, if the rumors are correct, you know, really the one of the best visual effects movies money can buy.
Yep.
You know, the rumors are that the two movies are gonna crest over $1 billion. You know, which is an insane number to
and
think
the thing
about.
Is, like, they still didn't give the guys enough time to do everything.
I know.
They were still rushing post.
Well, they were getting they got the footage. I mean, the stuff that we're looking at, you got 1,400 visual effect shots and all of the plates show up in January. You know, and you're releasing in, you know, in July.
That's crazy.
So over 6 months, you know, you're breaking that down. You know, it seems like, oh, yeah, they could do it in 6 months. But you're talking about, you know, doing approximately a little over 200 visual effect shots. If you did it with no ramp up, you're doing 200 visual effect shots. So truly, there's a ramp up of a couple months. Or a month, or at least a month. So you're really looking at 250 to 300 visual effect shots. You know, that cuts down to 10 or 15 visual effect shots. Complex, as hard as anything you've ever seen before, kind of visual effect shots being done, you know, 10 to 15 of them being done a day.
Mm-hmm.
And those kind of numbers are just insane.
Yeah, but, you know, they pulled
While they did farm out a bunch of shots to the orphanage and places,
right.
ILM still took, what, about 1,000 of those 1,400,
right.
And they were the hard ones.
Yeah, I like the effects supervisor actually said that. You know, yeah, we got rid of all the easy stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we handed off all these. We just dug it. And the thing is a lot of people ask, you know, what is the use of? There's a lot of discussion about, you know, can a company like ILM survive, or a company, these big visual effects companies? You know, what is their place when you have all these little companies that are, you know, these little whippersnappers that are doing, you know, that are coming up, and there a lot of them are ex, you know, they used to work at those big companies, and they found a niche in doing a lot of these visual effects. But I think that when you get down to, we're going to hand you 1,000 shots, and we're going to base all of our marketing on the fact that we depend on you to have them done in June.
Yep.
There's really, like, you know, two or three, maybe one place to go. I mean, people begrudgingly go to ILM because it's not the cheapest place to go to have your visual effects done. It's not really known for bargains. But it's the only place that you can walk in and you can hand them whatever, you know, at literally almost whatever deadline you have, and the number of shots, and it's going to come out the other end.
Yep.
I mean, I think the thing is that I was thinking it was Rob Coleman was talking at a conference I was at, and he was saying the trouble with films these days is that you get the pipeline sussed, you get it sorted, you start doing the shots, and just about when you're up to speed, you stop because the film's wrapped.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether, because they're doing these two films back-to-back, whether we'll see some even more amazing stuff in 3, because presumably they got up to speed on 2, delivered, but they're still going on 3, right?
Right. No, they're still shooting. They're cranking away. I mean, it barely stopped. You know, they took a rest. I know that. I think that the folks that I know that went back to that had to go back shooting, I think left in June. So they're you know, while we're watching the movie, they're finishing it up. They thought they could shoot everything all together, and I think that they're just, you know, they had a lot of challenges with the film related to weather. You know, we had all those you know, we had Katrina and all that other stuff going through last year, and that was going through areas that they needed to shoot in. And so so there was a lot of delays and move, you know, last summer was really, really a challenging shoot schedule for them. And then there's just a lot of stuff as a, you know, there was a couple of horror stories on the film where they changed the position of a camera, you know, from one side of the ship to the other, you know, after, you know, it's days of setup, which, you know, creates an enormous amount of loss, you know, in time and so on and so forth. But
I think you're so right about ILM. I mean, I don't know what you guys work on, but I guess the sort of rule of thumb we use is about 4 seconds of screen time a week for an animator. Mm-hmm. So if you're producing the kind of volume of character animation that they were doing with those multiple characters and Davy Jones, you need a facility that's got a lot of animators, have a lot of bums on seats
right.
to actually just get through that volume of work.
And it's just it's just being able to have a pipeline that can just, you know, handle that. And I honestly don't think that ILM had that pipeline before Star Wars, before the last three Star Wars. I mean, those are the movies that really forced them to really redefine how they did visual effects. You know, because they were...
I mean, they have a lot of proprietary stuff there, obviously, with Xeno and stuff, but surely one of the big IPs of any major facility now is the process itself.
Right.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, that is, how to do, you know, it. You've got to have it, and a lot of it has nothing to do with the actual effects making, you know, hands on the box kind of stuff. It's organizing it. It's the production side of things. It's databases to keep track of it all.
Well, and I think that that's one of the things that is vastly underestimated for a lot of little companies. One of the things I think that I grew to respect the most when I was working at ILM was the fact that it was, you know, the level of management, their ability to say, you know, you're not getting the shot, you know, at the rate you're going, you're not going to finish the shot until da 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 da, and they could nail it to the dime, mm-hmm. you know, of what that was gonna, you know, what that was gonna look like, because they had been there 1,000 times before, and you know, the producers had all been there, and you're working on. I mean, really, this is, you know, I would argue, you know, John Knoll has really become the go-to guy if you're doing a big film like this. You know, I don't know of that many other, what distinguishes him from, I think, a lot of other visual effects supervisors, and I speak as, you know, as a disclaimer, you know, John was primarily the visual effects supervisor I worked under for Star Wars. But one of the things that distinguishes him from a lot of other visual effects supervisors is he really has this. He started in motion control, you know, he has the physical end of things. He really understands all of that, but he also, you know, co-wrote or co-founded Photoshop, mm-hmm. so he understands the digital end of it as well. And so, so I think that is the, you know, that's what distinguishes him, is he kind of crosses over all those things, and he's not going to do things that don't make sense. You know, everything is efficient, you know, when you have someone like that on set, and that's very unique. I think that there's a lot of effects companies I find that you can see that they leaned really heavily towards digital because that's what they know, or they leaned really heavily towards analog because that's what they know. And I think there's only a handful of companies like ILM. I think Weta is another good example of a company that does not go one way or the other very much. They really pick the best technology for what they're doing.
When I was in London, Cinesite reminded me that they still shoot miniatures as well.
Who does?
Somebody there, Cinesite actually.
Cinesite, yeah.
Yeah, somebody there had heard one of the previous shows where we were listing companies that still shot them, and we omitted them. So
yeah, and
they nudged me on that one.
And a lot of I think that a lot of the larger companies that have been around for a while, I mean, they still understand what the value of that. There are limits to what you can do in CG. But I think,
but you got to get somebody that has been around that's comfortable with it. You know, you get a producer or a supervisor that isn't, and they're going to do what they know. So.
Right.
So pick some more shots that we can talk about.
The what did you guys think of the Kraken?
It was cool. I mean, in some ways...
That was the one that let me down. I just, you know, there was a moment where the Kraken's tail or whatever it was coming at camera, and I honestly had a flash of Monty Python. I expected Terry Gilliam to, like, have some kind of off-screen kind of thing. I just, I don't know, it was...
Was it the quality of the shot or the design of the...
I think it was... The shot, for some reason, didn't work. I think part of it was there was some very fast... sort of mega motion blur stuff just below deck that took me out of the film, because for a second I was just really aware that I was watching CG, and it had the motion blur artifacts, and it was the kind of ridiculous shots where people get picked up and hurled around.
Yeah, and that's where some of the compositing had issues too. It felt like the black levels weren't quite matched in some places. But
I'm going to stop
a couple times because we've had some questions about this kind of stuff. So we'll say things kind of out of the side of our mouth, and I want to make sure that people who are, you know, jumping into that. So Ron, let's talk a little bit about black levels.
Talk about black levels.
You know, because that's the kind of stuff that people will a lot of times step over. And so, what do you mean by the black levels were a little?
Sure, it's the basically the darkest things in the scene are considered your black levels, and a lot of times when you're compositing something into a shot, adding some CG into the shot, one of the main things you've got to do, of course, is match the color of the scene, but also, you know, what's considered black, what's considered white, and get those ranges correct. And it's particularly challenging with the blacks because, especially in something like Pirates, where you've got these Kraken tentacles whipping around, but there's all this smoke and atmospheric stuff going in there that nothing goes to pure black, not even close to it. You know, all the smoke and fog and stuff in the air lifts. It elevates everything, and if your CG has darker blacks than anything else in the scene, then it jumps out of you. You know, you may not know exactly why, but it doesn't sit quite in there. And there were definitely a couple places where it felt to me like, you know, stuff wasn't quite as it was a little bit too black, maybe.
Which is,
and it's a tough call.
Which is ironic because what ILM has a reputation for is the other direction. Mm-hmm. Of having things that have their black levels not be dark enough.
Yeah.
Which interestingly enough, you know, the gamma shift between film and video, a lot of times you'll see things on the DVD that you rent that is very different than what you saw on film, because when you watch it on a film screen, it has the blacks are deeper. Mm-hmm. And so you won't see that black level being off unless you watch it on the until you get it on DVD, you know, so it actually was accurate when you saw it on the film, and it's not accurate when you see it on TV. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you can do, by the way, for the people who do some of the effects, I mean, I don't know how much you guys do this, but, you know, I have a tendency to turn the gamma way up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, classic stuff is you've got to kind of boost things up, look at it, and trying to emulate, okay, well, if the video transfer is really, really bad, what's my worst case scenario, and try to do that, because stuff that you might not catch on a regularly calibrated monitor will start to show up if you boost it up or drop it down. So yeah, I think a lot of people do that. They'll cycle brightness up and down and get a good idea of, does it play well across the whole range?
Right, exactly. Now, Mike, what were you talking about before I interrupted?
I was going to say, for people that don't know as well, the other thing to remember is when somebody's working on a monitor, it's a very different type of color space, because you've got blacks that are basically not lit up phosphor. When you're in a cinema, you've got effectively a white screen that's trying to be black by the fact that there's no ambient light or directed projector light bouncing off it. Mm-hmm. So the way that blacks are on a projected bounced screen, even though they're made with this kind of weird projection material, versus what's happening on a CRT are vastly different. And the first time somebody that's compositing, it's quite new at it, sees their stuff projected, they're astonished at what's happening down in the blacks, because the physics of it's completely different, apart from anything else you might go into in terms of color space and stuff. So,
yep.
Yeah, handling those blacks is a very awkward, you know, projection problem.
Right. So anything?
I like the wide shots of the Kraken actually doing things to the ships, though, and pulling it in. And you know, at this point, ILM is, you know, all the incredible water stuff they do is almost like, oh, yeah, there's some photorealistic water too.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it feels like they've almost got that so dialed in, it's like a no-brainer. That I'm sure the people that actually worked on those shots are grumbling at my dismissal of how easy it must be nowadays, but they really have that pretty well dialed in for a lot of it.
Well, I think it was significant, because I think that it was significantly better. I think the water in this movie was significantly better than what we talked about earlier in Superman. I thought that the water looked better, you know, here.
But I also thought that what was interesting is that, talking to your point about miniatures before, there were some shots I just assumed were miniatures, like the Flying Dutchman coming out of the water,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where they were in fact shot on a very, very large open water thing they built in the Bahamas.
Right.
And actually had a ship coming out of the water, and they added digital water on top and stuff. And I thought that was pretty interesting, because I guess if you just think about a film of this size from a logistics point of view as well, I mean, the big trick in making a water film, if the film Waterworld taught us anything, was to try and film as much water stuff while the camera is based on land and you're looking out to water or over the top from a jetty underwater than actually going out to sea. Because once you go out to sea, you know, just you lose so many production days in shipping people out there and logistics and problems with power and just everything else under the
right.
sun. And so I think they built some really amazing sets that allow them to get a lot of stuff and a lot of stuff with natural skies rather than just, you know, stripping everything in with sky replacements.
Does anybody know?
A lot of that work...
When the Black Pearl is sort of washed up on shore there, how much of that was CG or practical?
I don't know.
I'm nearly 100% sure that ship was the ship that was on the beach that was up mm-hmm. there is a miniature. It was. I don't think I've seen it written anywhere, but I might have saw something that looks a lot like that, kind of close up.
Understood.
So it was about 25 to 30 feet long, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was but yeah, it's pretty funny. If you actually watch the edit, you'll notice that there's a you'll notice that the guys are walking they'll walk under and you'll see these big elements under them. So all the close-ups of them have just only hints of the ship.
Right.
And then they'll show you the wide shot and there's the ship, and then they go back to the guys close up. And so you'll notice that there's a little bit of avoidance of if they were, and this is just kind of a telltale, even if I hadn't had a spoiler myself, if you don't see them, if they had a big ship and they spent the money on putting a big ship on the beach, those guys would have, you would have seen wide shots of those guys walking in front of
them. You would have had that camera going all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, the producer would be like, we just spent a lot of money on that thing. You're going to show it over and over and over again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So if they're doing really close-ups and they're not showing you that, there's something else going on. And that's a perfect example of a ship like that, is a perfect example of something you want to do in miniature. And in fact, you're going to want to do it in something like, you know, 1/8 scale or 1/4 scale or something really, really big, because it's just so hard to get that in computer graphics. It's so hard to get the minutiae, you know, all those little details.
Yep.
It just turns out to be cheaper to just build the ship. You know, build a miniature.
Yeah, it looked great. I mean, that's why I was wondering. It, you know, I've kind of figured it had to be at least either a miniature or else a good chunk of it was a full size piece.
Right.
So yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
it's good.
Other shots that jumped out for you guys?
I was just going to say the point about we're having a bit of a go against the compositors, but I think we should really clarify this, because I don't know actually it is that the 3D was great and the compositing wasn't. I think it's because this film marked a significant thing for ILM that they were doing multi-pass rendering. I don't know if you guys picked up on that,
but
a lot of the stuff, you know, they had stuff in Maya, but they were doing RenderMan, and they were doing RenderMan with multi-passes, and those multi-passes were then presumably being composited together. Now, I don't know how much of that was in whose department, but I think one of the things that allowed them to produce such great 3D realistic final images was the fact that it was a multi-pass render.
Yes, absolutely.
And,
I think you're right. It's the you know, the compositors were doing that, and you know, I don't want to say that the compositing was bad at all. For me, it was like, it's the only surprise is the CG was pretty close to perfect as you're going to get, whereas I could find a couple places where the compositing didn't quite work as well for me. But yeah, I think it's something you're seeing a lot more of is this multipass stuff where you will render highlights and shadows and ambient versus diffuse versus specular versus, you know, normal passes. All these is separate things instead of just push a button and here's your element.
Well,
that's balanced together in the composite.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of people, when they think of 3D elements, they think of it being, you know, you're going to render it out the way it's going to look on film, and then you're just going to send it to a composite and they just kind of clump it over. And it is really the center of production. At least my experience has been the center of production really wraps around the compositor, and everything else just kind of feeds it the elements that it needs. You know, so the compositor is really sitting in the middle of a lot of that stuff oftentimes, and oftentimes dealing with all the problems that occur in the different areas. But there's, most of the shots that I worked on, for instance, were, you know, 25 or 30 passes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little curious as they pointed out that we can now do multipass, because, I mean, their multipass, especially at a place like ILM, has been pretty commonplace for a decade. And I think that maybe it was that they were able to automatically do some of the stuff without quite as much work. And it looked like it might be derivative passes. And I'll just have to get more information. I wasn't able to get more out of it, of being able to grab really complex relationships between the surfaces. Mm-hmm. I think that's the, I mean, you can get raw things like a specular, which is like the shininess or the reflectivity or the diffuse color versus the diffuse shading versus the normals. You know, all of these things are possible, but then there's a lot of complex interactions that if you only get those things, it's really hard to still create that flesh, especially the you know, getting a subtle specularity out of the subsurface scattering. So
yeah, I think all that subsurface stuff is, if you can do that as a separate path. Compositing layer, it gives you that great translucency that real flesh has. And again, I mean, that's, you know, God, every time I looked up close at the Davy Jones stuff, and it looked, you know, that's exactly the kind of stuff that really sells it, makes it look so good.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting thing, though. It's one of the big differences now between the houses. Like, if you look at a lot of the facilities, you get into similar kind of ways of doing things. It's obviously unique to each facility, but, you know, you can say, oh, yeah, well, that's probably a Mayer, and they probably did this, and they probably used shake here, and they probably used Renderman or whatever. But the one area that they vastly can differ on is whether they do a multipass or whether the 3D department delivers pretty much it nailed out of the render. I mean, Weta will, as almost a house kind of philosophy, deliver only maybe two passes, like a golem. They'll deliver golem and his hair separately, but everything else gets nailed in the render. You know, Pixar delivers everything nailed in the render, pretty much, whereas go the other extreme and Digital Domain will do everything as multipass and have huge pipelines through Nuke that are all separate. And I think it's one of the biggest differences right now in philosophies in big-scale post-production is whether or not you approach your 3D by trying to nail it and hand it off, or set it up as a very flexible thing to be tweaked later.
I think, you know, Sony is this sort of the same way as DD, or even more so, where they've got their own in-house compositing system, but it's not just a compositing system, it's a color and lighting system as well, and they're pretty much converging so that the person doing the compositing and the color and lighting is the same person. Which makes a lot of sense in some ways, because it's a very similar skill set in terms of being able to be the one that can balance things together and know what it takes. So, but it's very true that other facilities are completely opposite from that.
Yeah, and I have to admit that I definitely side heavily on the, you know, multi-pass approach. You know, it's one of those things that I have a hard time, you know, understanding how, you know, like for me, it's outside of my reality. And I have to, you know, it wasn't always outside of my reality. I remember there was this... back when I used this collection of electric image users. This is back when ILM used electric image a lot for hard surface stuff, and this is in the mid 90s, and probably 1995 or so. And they had this invitational, and I remember John Knoll coming in and showing one of the Mission Impossible jetliner. Last shot of the film, probably 2 seconds long, and he showed a multipass composite, and it was like. You know, it was like someone showing us a 747 when we've been flying biplanes, you know, and this multipass was just this just opened up everything that we saw. And suddenly all of us went to multipass. And what's interesting is to see anybody, like for me to see anybody not, you know, grabbing those components separately, it just seems like it's so much more work. And I could be wrong. I mean, I can understand that there's an approach of if you just nail it, if you just get him right, then you don't have to. There's a certain consistency to the render, like a golem, for instance. There's a consistency to how he's going to look if you just get it right and get all those surfaces there. But it seems like for so many shots that all the stuff is, it's always a different thing. It's always a different feel, and you're going to want to tune it. And it just seems like it'd be so hard to, you know, to me, after a decade of multipass, it's hard for me to imagine wanting to get, like if I just got a single pass, you know, I'd throw it back in the water.
But, you know, you look at King Kong and how good that looks.
Right.
And obviously, you know, you can nail the look either way.
Yep.
If you got the right people working on it. So
yeah, and it's just a matter of deciding how, you know, it definitely is a matter of where you're going to put the weight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it...
Yeah, I remember on Golem, they decided that it was basically try and stop simulating stuff and nail it in the algorithm. And it was basically subsurface scattering. And for elephants in the wide shots, they were using subsurface scattering and trying to just get it in one. And I mean, you know, obviously Lord of the Rings stuff was deservedly so, you know, Oscar recognized. So, but I think you're right. I mean, coming from a compositing background myself, I cause really favor multipass rendering and just love it to death and want more of it and get upset when we don't have pipes that work that way. And yet, you know, I do understand that there are people that believe that, you know, compositors screw up their lovely worked out renders by, you know, tweaking them to make them look more punchy and consequently produce stuff that doesn't look as real. And I respect that point of view.
Well, that's why I find it really interesting what Sony does, where they just make it the same person.
Well, and
it does both, and then there's no contention about who's screwing what up. You're only messing with your own stuff.
And that was the advantage of the stuff that I worked on. You know, for instance, we were, I was the animator and the lighting and the compositor. So I had the whole, you know, of the shots that I worked on, I had the whole, almost the entire pipe. I mean, there would be some models that I didn't do, and there'd be some matte paintings and some physical stuff that came in as passes. But outside of that, it was all my, you know, how it all came together. And if I needed to relight stuff or change stuff, it was on me, you know. And I think that definitely makes a lot of sense for these facilities to allow the compositor to, you know, be part of that whole process.
Yeah, I guess one thing that's good is that for people that are listening to the podcast that are kind of doing this stuff themselves or getting into it, I was really glad. I think it was last year, was it, Ron or Alex? You might know this, when they released RenderMan for Maya. So someone can actually get into doing multipass with RenderMan using the full RenderMan engine as just a plug-in for Maya and stuff,
mm-hmm.
which means that really it's really opened that up for people trying to do that on a, you know, less than ILM size pipeline.
Yeah, and just as an aside, I mean, as a a couple places for you to look. I mean, there's if you look at a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, you can find it. There's also if you go up to if people who are listening go to pixelcore.com on the, you'll see some training clips. You'll see like a little training thing on the main page. If you click on that, there's an explanation of a multipass, you know, in Photoshop, just kind of walking through multipass. If you want to know what multipass looks like, or what a whole lot of multipass would look like, you know, definitely check that out. Also, we just released a little plugin called Conduit, which is like a little nodal compositor for motion. And there's a bunch of examples on how to do multipass within Conduit, but you can see how multipass works. So if you're wondering what we're talking about, you'll get some sense of it between those two things. And both of those are on the one's on the DV Garage site under Conduit, and the other one is in the Pixelcore site. I know it's confusing. I have too many websites, but
congrats on the Conduit thing. That's amazing. That's really
it's very cool.
You know, hats off to you guys.
We're excited about it. I think it's hard for people who use motion to get their head around it. It's a very different thing, because it's like having a miniature kind of a very light version of Shake kind of sitting inside of Conduit. We really pushed FX Plug a little further than what I think even Apple thought was possible. And but it's really exciting. It's for those of you listening, it's a nodal compositor. So it's this kind of bringing a little taste of high end compositing into something like Motion. And eventually, whenever Final Cut Pro 6 comes out, if it fully supports FX Plug, you should be able to be in your editor doing nodal compositing. So anyway, if you want to check that out, it's on the DV Garage site. So, but it's lots of fun. Back to the movie. Other shots that really stuck out, other things that really popped for you, either good or bad.
We didn't really talk about. I mean, it wasn't just Davy Jones. Really, all the other sea creature characters and stuff. I mean, I kept wanting to see more of them, because each one had all these incredible different little details, the hammerhead shark guy and the, and even, you know, even
all
the background.
I don't know if you guys did the
same
thing that I did, but I was watching it was dark, and I was thinking, oh man, what a ripoff. They can only show these characters in the dark, you know, what a way to hide everything. And then, of course, as the film evolves, it's like full daylight. I'm like, okay, I'll take that.
Yeah, exactly. There was just no fear in this movie. You know, that's the thing. They went there. They just showed everything. It was great.
Yeah, and the full daylight shots were the ones on the deck with the crew, with this fully CG crew, was just it was just amazing. Mm-hmm. You know.
You know what? You can tell how good it is if you go back and look at Pirates of the Caribbean 1. Because I went and compared that preparing for today, and I looked at the scenes of the CG characters when they're first revealed in the moonlight, and the motion was good, but it just didn't compare. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just really didn't compare to the stuff they're doing.
And I will say there were a handful of shots where the CG character seemed a little light. You know, that there's this little lightness that shows up every once in a while. Like there's not quite enough weight to them. Mm-hmm. There was a handful of shots where I felt like that, but man, it was just a handful. And generally, anytime there's a lot of that stuff, I feel it all the time.
Yeah, they did motion capture on some of this, I know, right?
Yeah, I think they did motion capture on most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really the way, I think that there's, for those of you listening, once again, there's motion capture versus hand animation is kind of this, it's almost like a religious battle at times at these effects facilities where, you know, the animators feel like they could do a better job if they did it by hand. The motion capture is faster. Motion capture is, of course, where you have all those little dots all over you, and it's faster, definitely. And then the question is it more accurate? Is it less accurate? And I tend to lean towards, when you're doing a animated film like Cars, I think you want it to be hand animated. I think that it has to be larger than life. It has to move that. When you're trying to integrate CG characters that are humanoid in with human characters, I feel like you almost always have to use motion capture. I think that I feel like every time I see characters that aren't motion captured, I feel like they're not, you know, it just doesn't, it does, it's like a drawing inside of a photograph.
I think that's definitely, you know, the huge advantage that hand animating has is you can exaggerate stuff. You can use it to tell a story intentionally, but it works, you know, much better if you're doing that in something that's designed to be, you know, like Cars and an exaggerated kind of thing.
Because I love that when they had the fight sequence on the island, where all the CG characters run up on the island, that they didn't leap breaking the laws of physics. That, I mean, okay, the head fell off, that kind of stuff was funny, but do you know what I mean? Like they were running, interacting, they just had the constraints of physics. It wasn't like, oh, we're CG characters, so we can do anything, and one guy can leap from tree to tree to tree.
Right.
And it's like in the Hulk, for example, yeah. Right, where you're this big, heavy character who was like a friggin' fairy jumping
right.
through the air. And I was like, well, yeah.
I agree. I think that always looks just terrible. And especially when they try to do it with, you know, what are supposed to be real humans that do these outrageous stunts that just don't look real.
Yeah,
you know,
and these guys felt that they were constrained by the physical environment. Mm-hmm. They felt like they were constrained by
right.
gravity. Presumably, Alex, because they were captured on...
And if they weren't, then they were... It was really good hand animation, and I take it all back.
And I'm sure it's a combination of that. I mean, you know, you say that motion capture is faster, but there's a lot of post-processing that goes on, and some of it's actual reanimation, some of it's just data cleanup. I mean, it's not...
Oh, I've been in that trench as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of times what happens is, especially if they're shooting on set, that something will occlude it. You know, one of the actors, for instance, will step in front of the character, and the cameras, the little cameras that are watching those markers, can't see some of the markers, and the markers just start... You know, you can constrain them to some degree, but there's a lot of, like, they start popping around and just kind of, because they don't know, the system doesn't know where those markers are because it can't see, and it doesn't have enough cameras tracked on it. And a lot of that damage can occur. And then there's the damage of the CG character versus the real character. If they're different in height, size, so on and so forth, changing the joint positions can end up with all kinds of popping and, you know, all kinds of fun mm-hmm. stuff.
And in the same way that we're praising them for keeping their characters grounded under physics, can I also send out kudos to the guys at, I think, Company 3 that did the DI grade on it? Because unlike Superman, which for me, while a good film, had issues with just taking the grade too far and making it look kind of fake, I thought the grading on this was magnificent. It looked like it was an adventure fun thing, but it didn't have lollipop ridiculous skies. It didn't have everything looking like it was completely unnatural and could never be achieved because they just graded the heck out of it. And obviously they did grade it a lot because it was very consistent. So I think whoever did the DI grade, and I think it was Company
right.
3, did an outstanding job in kind of walking that line of, you know.
Yeah, it looked really nice.
Hollywood,
and you could see every, you know, you could see what you needed to see. I mean, unlike Da Vinci Code, which I thought was, you know, graded down to where it was just mud in places.
Mm-hmm.
They kept the detail in there. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, there's definitely, it's an eye candy film, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and I strongly would suggest people who watch it, I don't care what you see in the reviews, if you're interested in visual effects at all, if you're interested in it, this is the kind of film that you go to see in a big screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is, I mean, like, for instance, I really want to see, you know, we were talking about this thing before the show, I really want to see who killed the electric car, but I can see, you know, I'm going to try to see it in the theater, but the theaters that they show it in are, you know, almost the size of the one I have at home, you know what I mean? So, and it's, I could watch it on DVD and it'd be just as good. This is not one of those things. Sideways would be just as good if I watched it on my DVD player, it's, you know, that, but this is a visual extravaganza. And it really is worth seeing. And it's definitely seen. I saw it, I think we've talked about this before. I'm kind of obsessed with seeing things just pure digital. Mm-hmm. And it's that's a great experience. It's not seeing any grain, but not seeing any scratches or pop.
Weave and float and stuff.
Any of that stuff. Yeah. It's just a pure digital, which they do. They have quite a few theaters here in San Francisco, and I'm sure they have a couple in L.A. Do they have a lot of digital theaters in Australia, Mike?
No. In fact, it's been a real issue because, as with most places, it's a who pays for it problem. And, you know, they've had a couple of... They brought one in and they didn't notice any significant increase in audience attending that cinema versus the one next door that was normal, so they didn't invest the money kind of thing. So it's... there is a little, but it's really behind, and I think probably an experience borne out in other countries around the world.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I have to admit for me that once I saw one full digital, I just... If I'm ever given the choice, I very quickly go to full digital.
I totally agree. I was stunned at how much weave and float and stuff was being introduced.
That's the
thing
that I really
level.
Notice. It's just, you know, bobbing around and then how rock steady the digital stuff is.
And that's the thing is when you're watching this, I mean, you don't realize how much of that is going on until you see it without it. Mm. You know, and it...
But I will say one other thing. I think that part of the problem, and this may be just me, but part of the problem is if somebody's going to set up a digital cinema, they go to quite a lot of trouble to get the light levels right and get it sorted. Yep. Whereas a multiplex that doesn't pay a lot of attention to anything certainly doesn't pay a lot of attention to those issues on a film. And so you can have... I mean, I've had atrocious audio and just really bad ambient light coming into the cinema, and it's just... I feel like in an industry that should be fighting for quality, they're, you know, just worrying about the candy bar and nothing else.
That's where they make their money.
But that's a whole different discussion, I know. But, it is really a criminal thing to see a beautiful film badly.
Well, I have to admit, there's only about... I know in San Francisco, there's only about three theaters that I'll see any kind of major film in. You know, I mean, it just... Actually, two. Mm. I just, you know, there's like the Venice 1000 and the Metreon, and those are... They're both AMC at this point, but they're the only ones if it's a major film, you know, and you just get into this point where there's only a handful of theaters, you know, that really pay any attention.
And the other good thing about digital projection is it doesn't seem to degrade. Yeah. You know, it's the other thing. If you don't get to see a major release film in the first couple of days, once it's been run a number of times, it seems to get dirtier and worse.
Splice marks where they have to put it back together.
And do you guys have this phenomenon in the States where there are suddenly dots projected on the screen?
We had a long discussion about that in This Week in Media a couple of weeks.
That was where it was.
Yeah, we were talking about that. That's the DRM.
Mm-hmm.
That's like visual graffiti.
It drives me nuts.
Offensive.
It's and you know, one of the people that was on the This Week in Media hadn't noticed it yet, and I think we spoiled him. He's out there catching it now, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. For,
you know, once you start getting attuned to it, it's pretty annoying. It's just so obtrusive. It's not, you know, there's so many things they could have done that would, you know, have exactly the same capabilities in terms of tracking where this stuff comes from that wouldn't be so in your face. But I just cannot believe it every time I see it. There's giant red dots popping. And, you know, yes, it's one frame, but... I don't know. People see it.
Yeah, no, definitely, and it's a, it's tracking where that, you know, where that, which reel is where, the dots have to be big enough so that if you record it on your camcorder, that they'll still show up and be readable. You know, that's the whole.
But there's
red
so
dot
many things
issue.
They could have done that, you know, because it's all just compared to some baseline. So there's plenty of things you could do that wouldn't be red dots that you could still do a little bit of analysis and pull that information back out.
Yeah, it's
so swinging back to the film for a second, if it was not incredibly premature, as we've in, I guess, the middle to the end of the summer blockbusters in the US, do you think Pirates is the best, you know, for an Academy shortlist that we've seen so far? Or?
Yeah, and here's the scary thing is we're going to get another one before the end of the year.
Is this coming out the...
If I'm correct, it's due out in Christmas.
I thought it was... Really? Yeah. I thought it was 07.
Split the vote.
Is it split 1 year out?
Yeah, I thought so, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I thought, I don't know why, but I thought that it was coming out. I thought it was, no, you're right. I don't know when it is. I'm not going to try to say. I need to go to IMDb Pro and we'll figure it out. But the
If you had to pick the best ones this year, I haven't seen Superman, but
I think that right now it's the most seamless.
Yeah,
you know, I think when I looked at the rest of the schedule for the year, and I think about what I just saw, I can't imagine another one being bigger. Bigger in expanse, and I feel like, I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, there's a lot of other things that could happen this year, but the biggest uphill battle for ILM has been, there's been kind of a political shift in, you know, at the Academy of not voting ILM films, I think partially because they won so many of them. You know, there's a little bit of spread the love kind of stuff that goes on.
The Weta effect, yeah.
You know, that sometimes they put out some amazing stuff, but they've won so many. They're trying to. I think that there's some kind of more. It's more political at this point than technical some of the time.
Well, I think also there's that phenomenon that you see with showreels as well, which is that basically space films don't win, and people don't want to see space stuff on your showreel. At least not the first thing up. And I don't know why that is, but you know, like. I would say, why wasn't Battlestar Galactica nominated for more Emmys? You know, the same reason. Like, and I think that's outstanding visual effects work for the guys on Battlestar Galactica. I think certainly that's what something more worthy about a Tolkien novel than a Star Wars film, just at a literary level. And I think that's worked against
it does. You know, no matter whether it should be about the visual effects or not, it does come back to being about the movie too. It always does, no matter which discipline you're talking about. And, you know, but
doesn't go well for a comedy, does it? Because you'd have to class Pirates as a comedy, and comedies never seem to go well.
Yeah, but it's been reasonably financially successful, so I think that helps.
Yeah, it's
reasonably.
Oh, you know, it did okay. They've only made what, $150 million in the last couple of days.
Yeah,
so biggest opening, the biggest opening weekend ever.
I think it was like the biggest opening day, the biggest opening 2 days, the biggest opening 3 days. You know, it just slammed all directions by quite a bit too.
And it was one of the few effects films, I have to say. I mean, I keep on coming back to my wife, but it's one of the few effects films that I was like, I want to, I got to go see this because I got to review it, and she was immediately wanted to go. You know, and that's a distinction.
Johnny Depp.
Yeah, and that's unusual. So.
Well, at least it wasn't based on a comic book.
Right, yeah. All right. Well, I think that we've reached the end of our plank.
Yep.
For the day.
Very good.
Though I will say it felt like the height of hubris just to criticize ILM's work on that film, because I mean, it was on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, we're picking between 9.5 and 9.9.
I'd say I think we're picking between 9.9 and 10. I mean, it, you know, we were fiddling with, you know, a handful of shots that you know, and this has been more of the case. I mean, with a lot of these larger films, we talk about them because that's our, you know, it's kind of our job to point out some stuff and look at it. But this is probably one of the most seamless visual effects films I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think of another film that was, I cannot think of another visual effects film that was as seamless, that had more than 1,000 visual effects shots in it.
Yep.
And there's a lot of them.
I agree.
You know, it used to be, to say more than 1,000 visual effects shots, it was, you know, there was like one. But now there's, you know, that's a fairly common thing. You get a couple a year now. And I cannot think of one that had that many visual effects shots that was as seamless and as aggressive in a lot of ways.
Well, that's the thing, especially when you factor in, like I said, how just balls out they were with, you know, showing stuff. Yep.
Tommy, just as a comparison, just in character animation, do you think as a digital actor in a film as like a supporting actor role, do you think that Davy Jones was better or Yoda, just in terms of animations, forget, you know, subculture? Because I mean, I found Yoda to be sensationally well animated.
Well, Davy Jones it was hard to judge because Davy Jones was face, you know, it was all facial stuff really.
Yeah, I think Davy Jones had bigger.
So
I think Davy Jones had bigger. You know, I have to admit, there was a lot of the Yoda animation. Not so much the close stuff. I think Yoda looked great. I think there was a lot of the stuff where, you know, especially like fight sequences and stuff that just didn't work at all.
Yeah, see, that's the gravity thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like
you were talking
for me,
about, Mike, it's
that's where Yoda really didn't work for me at all. Was in the stuff where he had to move a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think Yoda was fantastic in the closer, you know, that type of stuff. And we didn't. Davy Jones for some reason didn't have to pull out a lightsaber and start flying around. So I can't really compare apples to apples there. But I think that It's hard for me. I have to look back on it. I have to play it back and forth.
I'd have to watch them both side by side again.
I guess it's a compliment that both of those were ILM games.
Right, and I,
and at some point, when you get to where it's just so good that you kind of feel it's flawless, I mean, how do you really pick one or the other? So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, it was, it's as, I do think that it, in many ways, it was kind of a pinnacle and, you know, of, you know, there's, as I said, I tried to think of it on the way out of thinking of a film that I thought was more flawless, as far as just, I just couldn't, you know, it's just almost perfectly shiny of, I didn't, you know, of what I saw. And I said there was a handful of little things that grabbed onto me, but really, it was an amazing, amazing film. Looking forward to the next one.
Yep.
So,
definitely. And,
yeah, exactly.
Richards, right?
They should have one of Depp's crew. They should put Keith Richards in there, just for.
He's going to be in the next.
This isn't
one.
An original comment because
he is going to be in the next one as Johnny Depp's father.
Yeah,
yeah.
But this isn't an original comment. But wasn't this film Return of the Jedi? I mean, sorry, Empire Strikes Back, the Caribbean version. I mean, all we needed was some character to turn around to Johnny Depp and say, I'm not your father. There was the love triangle. There was the character that's the rogue. There was that character in peril at the end of the second film.
Oh, my goodness. He's pulling the parallel here. It's actually, you know.
I'm sorry. I'm just saying it. I just couldn't get over it when I was thinking about it after we left the film.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I have to admit, I'm just going to say that I wish that I had been more insightful, but... you know, all we have to do is find out that Keira Knightley and their brother and sister, and then we'll be
right.
You know, then it'll be complete. You know, it's actually fairly frightening. So
it is actually, and
the parallels just keep on going. That's the funny thing about it.
Oh so, yeah. Anyway, that was one of the best Star Wars films. So.
Yeah, exactly.
You do worse.
Exactly. So Pirates of the Caribbean.
So as long as we don't get Ewoks in the third version.
Yeah, let's not. That's all I got to say. Let's keep the Ewoks out of the situation here. Anyway, so from Down Under once again, Mike Seymour from FX Guide and FX PhD. Thanks, Mike, for joining us. And Ron, of course. Ron, are you in Redondo Beach?
I'm in Santa Monica.
Santa Monica,
right now, but.
Ron Brinkman in Santa Monica.
DigitalCompositing.com.
In where?
DigitalCompositing.com. Right. I'll plug my website, even though there's nothing on
there. There's nothing there, but that's the website there.
You can go buy books and give me Amazon points.
That's a worthy cause. Definitely worth doing. And so Ron Brinkman, and I'm Alex Lindsay. And what are we doing, Ron?
Keep it real.
All right, thanks.
There you go.